This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Good afternoon. We are talking cravings and we are talking innovation today. And by innovation, I mean people who are taking little risks that make their business better, their setting, or certainly leading trends. They're influencing what we do in this industry. And so I've got two fellows here in this studio that are going to help me have this discussion with you. The third is going to be on the phone because he's celebrating a very large anniversary today. And we're very pleased to be able to have a bit of a yarn to him. Matty Fallon is here from Denord. Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
Focus of the discussion from you today is new Nordic cuisine. Sort of. And that's a fairly broad church.
Very much so.
So if we look to people like Magnus Nielsen, who is up at Favikan, probably the world's most isolated restaurant, he is part of that new Nordic movement in Sweden. Obviously, René Redzepi goes without saying as the number one restaurant in the world.
Yep.
At Noma in Denmark, and of course, Christian Puglisi, who is an Italian boy, but also
Danish-Italian,
who's doing big stuff. Who have I missed? There's a couple of others that...
There's heaps now. There's the guys at Maimo. I think I'm saying that right.
Yes. We'll pretend it's right because no one's going to challenge us.
They're by all means adopting the new Nordic movement, that sort of thing. It's blown up, especially in that part of the world. But, yeah, it sort of hasn't moved across shores until now, I guess.
But we're seeing some of the techniques, some of the ideas, some of the influence of new Nordic cuisine sort of filtering across the United States, Europe, and here to some degree as well.
By all means. Mm. There's places in New York, like Oscar. It's another like Swedish based with the new Nordic movement and stuff like that. He was in the back, the guy, Frederick, something I can't pronounce.
Yep.
Another one of those
They're
ones.
They're not easy names to
not
pronounce.
Not at all. Too many dots above the letters and stuff like that. So we'll just wing it for now.
Excellent.
But like he started off doing new Nordic food, or basis of new Nordic food in Williamsburg at the back of the Kinfolk Studios.
Yep.
Got a Michelin star within the first
5 minutes.
Yeah, basically of opening. It's a really good movement, and it's a different approach to a lot of food.
We'll talk about over the next sort of 45 minutes. Also with me is Kyle Duty. He is from Mr. Miyagi in Windsor. Welcome. For your first time, a cravings virgin.
Come on now.
Seems to be fewer and far between.
He's gentle.
Very gentle. You're dealing with some innovation in Japanese cuisine, or certainly parts of Japanese cuisine, predominantly Japanese street food.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting sort of area to bring the Japanese food into the modern era and funk it up a little bit and make it a little bit more street food and a bit more accessible.
Could I challenge the street food idea, given that, you know, we've been... The thing that I saw most in Japan when I lived there were ramen stands, noodle stands everywhere. And, I mean, we've sort of had that influence just to walk down Swanston Street and there's a udon or a ramen house every four or five stores. So where are you going that's not been traditionally done from a street food point of view?
From a street food point of view, I guess it's about making some of the izakaya classics that you might not find on the street, like say their fried chicken, karaage, and making it into massively huge fan
with a truckload of kewpie mayonnaise.
Yeah, that stuff's like kitty crack.
It is. Interestingly, I saw this week that kewpie are releasing some flavored mayonnaise. So they're doing one that's wasabi. One that's got a chili.
Yep, and yuzu.
And yuzu.
Yuzu would be good.
Yeah, wouldn't that be fantastic? Kewpie mayonnaise with yuzu. Ooh. I could just paint myself in that stuff. Yeah.
We do a burnt miso Japanese mayonnaise with our salmon kushiyaki, which goes quite well. But, you know, getting back to the street food side of it, I guess, you know, kakiage being like their corn balls that they do. We're doing like a really fun, playful tempura battered corn ball with some spiced popcorn, but we use like dehydrated corn that you find in like the, you know, that barbecue artificial cheesy bright yellow
stuff.
Mm-hmm. You know, we grind that up, we mix it with some smoke powder, and we come up with something quite inventive.
Yep,
it's bloody delicious.
Please tell me that you're going to do something clever with takoyaki.
Takoyaki, yeah, I'm working on prawn donuts. So, takoyaki, of course, being octopus balls.
Yes,
does which it sound
sort of batter
so
with pickled octopus in the middle. Oh no, they are fantastic. Yeah. It's sort of this egg shaped batter with pickled octopus in the middle. It's just fabulous stuff.
And you see them on the streets, and they're poking them with sticks at a mad rate of speed.
Also set with Kewpie mayonnaise and some
taco sauce.
Yeah, and
katsuobushi.
Yeah. Help me out here. The dried tuna.
Bonito. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, so katsuobushi we use quite a lot in our cuisine, being a dried, fermented, and smoked, very fine bonito fish flake. Mm-hmm. It dances on the plate and carries on.
It's beautiful. Visually, it's quite stunning.
It's great. People just think the aircon's on too high. Why is my food moving?
Joy, 94.9.
On the phone is a young man whose career I've been rather enamoured by, and as we're talking innovation today on the program, he is somebody who has always been innovative, and my definition of innovation is be willing to take a risk with what are industry norms. His name is Rory Lane. The wines he makes are The Story Wines. Rory, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Pete. Great to be on Cravings again.
Oh, it's good to have you, mate. I'll get you in the studio one of these days and we can have a glass of wine after about the 17th of September.
Yeah.
Tell me, you're obviously setting up for a celebration today, and that celebration is 10 years?
10 years, that's right, yeah. It seems to have flown by, but yeah, 10 years since we made our first wine in 2004.
Now, for those that don't know, give us a bit of an idea of the evolution of Story Wines.
Okay, well, the brief version is that back in 2004, I decided I wanted to run a winery, but I didn't really have any of the normal things that you have to run a winery, which is A, money, and B, a vineyard. So I decided just to buy some grapes and rent a little factory space, and I put a tiny amount of equipment into it and just gave it a bash, essentially. And I really wanted to make wines from the Grampian.
Yep. What's the attraction to the Grampians?
Look, at the time, there was a lot of really big, really high-octane Shiraz that was made in other parts of the world and in other parts of Australia, and it wasn't really my thing. So I wanted to make wine from a region that made more elegant styles, medium-bodied Shiraz that was, you know...
A little more finesse, a little more feminine?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. So, yeah... Just made 100 cases in 04 with sort of basically a credit card and not much else. And every year since then, we've increased the volume little by little. And we're still making wine in a little factory space. Now it's a slightly larger one down in Tarim.
Yep.
But yeah, we're essentially a very small garage winemaker.
How many cases of wine do you produce per vintage or per year?
Now we're at about 2,500, which is kind of seems like a lot, but it's tiny compared to most wineries.
And you're making a series of wines, and not one or two anymore. It's how many in your range?
Well, we've got about six now.
Yep.
A couple of single vineyard Shirazes, kind of an entry level Shiraz, and then some Henty Riesling, some Henty Pinot as well.
Yep.
And a little bit of Marsan Riesling and Viognier.
Oh, I'm mad on MRV at the moment. It's nuts. Being produced really, really well across several regions in Victoria. So up in the Rutherglen region, there's a nice MRV from up there. Lovely stuff coming out of central Victoria and Strathbogie.
Yeah, well, they're kind of unheralded wines, but I reckon they're great. They're so textural and they work well with so many different foods.
Mm.
You've got to get onto it.
So talk about this current innovation of yours, and I know that the competition as such is closed, but how are you trying to combine literature and wine?
Yes, well, I decided that I wanted to try and, I guess, bring a little more to wine than just what was in the glass or what was in the bottle. I've been a long-time reader and lover of literature. I did an arts degree, which, you know, got me all the way into winemaking. And... But since then, I've been looking for a way to sort of combine the two passions. And so we decided that we'd start a short story competition together with Overland magazine, which is a really well-respected literary mag.
Yep.
And essentially all we did was just gave people ocean splatter and said, it's 1,000 words, write any kind of prose that you want, and the winner will get, firstly, $3,000 prize, which we've stumped up for, and then they'll also get their story published in Overland, which is no mean feat. But thirdly, they'll also get their story printed in full on our next Shiraz label.
How are you going to put 1,000 words on a small Shiraz label?
It fits just. The print's kind of small, but it's a bloody big bottle of wine. I've been told that perhaps you should include a little microphone, like a magnifying glass or something in with the bowl.
Yeah, just on a neck tag. That'd be a great idea.
Yeah, yeah. But no, you'll be able to read the whole thing.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it was just something that we thought we'd give a bash to and try and support Australian writers and Australian writing in a small way. And the first year's been huge. We had over 400 entries, and
wow.
I kind of feel a bit sorry for the judges to have to wade through 400,000 words. But
So you've got literary people doing the judging, so people from Overland?
Yeah, we've got one of the editors of Overland, and then we've got a respected author as well, and we've also got Campbell Mattinson from...
And that man, that man's known for putting a few words down on paper.
Oh, yeah, he can write. He can write.
He's actually a good guy. For those who don't know, Campbell Mattinson, one of our preeminent wine writers. He's from Porepunkah up in the northeast of Victoria. A very clever man. He's written a number of books of red wine, and he's just, I think, not long ago, last week, at the James Halliday Wine Companion Awards, has been announced as the new person who's going to be tasting alongside James for the 2016, so next year's Wine Companion. Yeah.
Correct. No, he's a great guy.
Jeez, it helps that I read the paper. I do have a couple of guys in the studio, Rory, that I haven't introduced you to. Maddie Fallon from Dunord.
Hello.
Hi, how you going, Matt?
Good,
And Kyle is here from Mr. Miyagi.
Hey, mate.
Kyle.
Hi.
You've always sort of been willing to take a bit of a risk with the way you make wine and with doing what you do. Do you consider yourself an innovator or a risk taker?
I wouldn't put it at the top of my CV, but I think you've really got it. You've got to do new things to keep current, to give something extra to the buying public out there, to keep people engaged, and also to keep yourself engaged. Because, you know, if you do the same thing over and over again, it gets a bit boring.
Indeed. Would you guys agree that you've got to...
Completely.
You've got to take risks. For sure. Yeah. You've got to put yourself out there and separate yourself from what everybody else is doing.
But how much of a risk you take at the potential damage to the business?
It's all calculated, isn't it? You know, you wouldn't make Shiraz and the Grampians if it didn't make sense.
It was crap. Yeah, true.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose you do weigh them up, but maybe you say, okay, well, this doesn't make 100% commercial sense, but I'll give it a go anyway. You don't bet the house on it, but you've got to be willing to bet a bit.
Well, yep. You kind of bet your credit card on it, so.
Have you paid off the credit card that you started with?
I've paid off that one.
just got another one. Mate, you've obviously had some support from a fairly close-knit family. How important has your family been to the success that you're seeing now?
Hugely. In a kind of moral support way, they've been great. My family never said to me, God, you're stupid going to make wine. They always said, wow, that sounds like fun. And that's, it is fun. But I think just your family giving you the freedom to go and pursue your passion is the biggest thing.
That's what families are supposed to do. They're supposed to support your dreams, aren't they?
Yeah, I
hope so. Excellent. Now, today's event, your 10-year celebration, is oversubscribed, so we won't tell people where it is. But for those who are interested in finding out a little bit more about your wine and indeed your own story, your website?
Is thestory.com.au.
Excellent. And the wines are stocked at Black Hearts and Sparrow, Boccaccio.
Yeah, I think you can also find them, some of them at Vintage Cellars. We're kind of 80% on-premise, so the retailers are in the minority. But go to the website.
Yes, go to the website, you'll find all the stockers. Mate, good luck. Continue to success for another 10 years or more doing what you're doing. Like I said, we've always been impressed by your story and the way that it's all unfolded for you. So we wish you continued success. Enjoy your 10th celebration, your 10th birthday. I hope somebody's done something about cake.
I don't know. I hope so. I wouldn't mind a bit of cake.
I reckon a candle in a lump of cheese is probably a good start.
Oh, that'll do me fine, Pete.
Excellent. Oh, mate, always good to talk to you, and thanks again for your time. Good luck for today.
Thanks, Pete. Thanks, guys. See ya.
Cheers.
See ya.
Cheers. That is Rory Lane. He is from the Story Wines. Are you guys familiar with his wine?
I've heard of it before.
I've heard of it, but I don't know if I've sampled it. I feel like I'm going to, though.
If you are still listening, by all means, we need to sample it.
Well, for somebody who's, you know, who is, as he said, he's making wine in a shed in Carrum, they are of incredible quality. And I think it's like being a chef in some regards. I think that some people are just born to practice this art.
Yeah.
And I think he was born to make wine because the wines are spectacular. They're award-winning, they're beautifully structured, they're really finely balanced, they're really delicious wines. And I'm not one for... this is certainly not a plug for his wine. He's a very smart young man, and it's people like him that are going to sort of see us into the next generation of winemaking as well.
Yeah.
Which is good.
Joy 94.9.
We are talking about innovation today on the program, and we're about to delve into New Nordic cuisine and Japanese street food. Let's go back to New Nordic cuisine. We talked about some of the people that are sort of leading this charge and a part of this movement, which takes in Sweden, Denmark, parts of Norway. Is Norway involved? Or
there's a place in Norway that's the Maimo place. They're, they're really involved. Iceland, everywhere, really.
Scandinavia.
Scandinavia, the whole Nordic region. I don't know of anything from Greenland, but...
There's nothing on Greenland.
I don't think there's anything happening there.
Moose.
Frozen fish.
If we talk about what New Nordic cuisine is, because I don't think it's a very easy thing to define.
It's not. It's a really hard one to explain, but it's really simple. So it's the approach is a lot of like localism and stuff like that. The techniques are, by all means, like traditional Scandinavian-style techniques, like fermenting, smoking, preserving, pickling, so, you know, harsh winters, that sort of thing.
Yep.
Everything is based on seasonality, as all chefs should base their food. Aside from that, it's just like any other style of cooking. It's limited. We limit ourselves to try not to use any other ingredients that wouldn't necessarily be
present,
like it did in the Nordic regions.
A lot of foraging, no?
Just tons of foraging. So foraging, for me, I'd never foraged until we did.
Yeah.
This side of things. Did
eating
a few
twigs.
Forage. Twigs is good.
I did a... sorry, I hate to interrupt. I've hosting masterclass for the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival over the last 4 years, and I've met guys like Magnus Nielsen, who, as I said before, from Favakan in Sweden, the world's most interesting and, I think, isolated restaurant.
Yeah.
And he just goes out and sort of gathers twigs and stuff, and they do stuff with these twigs.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a different approach. You open your eyes a lot more towards... trying to do something different, I guess. Like, I mean, there's a lot of failed attempts, by all means.
But that's part of the parcel of what we do.
Exactly right. I mean, we were trying to do like autumn leaves, like steaming vegetables in autumn leaves and stuff like that, and sort of presenting them as if it looks sort of like forest floorish sort of thing. Failed horribly, but the concept's there.
Don't always hit it out of the park.
Exactly right. Yes, I mean, we certainly try, and in my head, it always makes sense, and this is going to be great. But
yeah,
on the other hand, it really sometimes doesn't.
Yeah, look, but I think that is the same with anything that you're trying to, where you are trying to be innovative, where you are trying to create something that is maybe an old technique but in a new form.
Yep.
There is always going to be failure. If you look at Heston Blumenthal,
exactly.
That man's had more failures than you can poke a stick at.
Yeah.
But every now and then when he hits success, that's when your mouth just goes bang.
Yeah, completely.
How much influence did you take from people like Magnus and Renee and Christian and others?
Heaps. Certainly Christian Pulisi.
He's a dude, by the way. He's a very cool man.
He's a super cool guy. Super cool guy. He's the most influential for me at the moment in the approach to dining, I guess. He's sort of tried to make food more accessible on a higher level, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So, you know, like set courses for a low amount of money. I think it's like $45 it works out to be to do 5 courses there.
Which is cheap.
It's super cheap.
Mm.
So sort of trying to scale that down to what we're doing at Denord at the moment. We had a trial run just through social media last week and just did 4 courses for $30 just to see if it works.
Yep.
And then sort of challenging what we can actually come up with in that.
You can't buy a steak for $30. Jump on the microphone there for me, Kyle, because I want to see how much of what Maddie's talking about translates to what you're doing at Mr. Miyagi from... talk me through seaweed tacos.
Seaweed tacos, yeah, it's an interesting one. So the sort of whole approach was to pick an iconic sort of dish that makes sense. And, you know, who doesn't love a damn good taco? So, you know, what we do there is we take the nori sheets that you'd see in any sushi shop. And
you can buy them in the supermarket.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. They're really available. They come in different grades. And we fry them in tempura batter, once again. Make a really lovely crispy shell. And inside of that, we put some vinegared sushi rice. Mm-hmm. So, once again, you can easily source these ingredients at the supermarket. Sushi rice is, you know, probably down aisle 8 next to the rice wine vinegar.
Or next to the arborio.
Exactly right. So from there, we put some kimchi, so some fermented sort of Korean cabbage and chili.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we infuse some salmon belly with kombu. Kombu being a seaweed, which is highly prized for its umami. Mm. You know, we're all about sort of maximizing.
For those that don't know, is the fifth sense of food. It's that perfect taste.
It's the happy dance. Mm.
It is the happy dance. Okay. Vision in my head, but go on.
Yeah, and then we take this the salmon belly and we slow cook it at 90 degrees, mm-hmm. and we flake it up on top, and we use a fermented soybean. It's not one of those stringy natto.
I was going to say it's not like natto, is it? Because that stuff is disgusting.
That stuff's not for me either.
No, it's vile.
My 8-year-old loves it.
It's like, for those that have not tried natto, let's try and give it an explanation. It's like little
fermented soybeans. So basically, it's like a par-cooked soybean.
It's like snot.
It's like snot.
And they have it for breakfast. It's got a vile smell. It smells like vomit.
It's disgusting. It is the durian of the Japanese world.
It is indeed.
I'm not going to go very popular.
No, that's fine.
Right. Okay. So anyway, then we top that off with some of this fermented soybean chili. So it's not like that. It's like a soybean which has been infused in a chili sesame oil. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, we have some Japanese mayonnaise, some spring onions, and some micro coriander just to give it a bit of punch. The young shoots of the coriander really complement. So it's everything that you'd expect in a taco, the red bean being replaced by a soybean, the meat aspects being from the salmon. It looks like a taco. It eats like a taco, but
doesn't
it's
taste like
so
a taco.
Not a taco. It's like the most ramped up taco you'll probably put in your mouth.
So I guess what I'm hearing there through all of that is a very big focus on combining new Western style technique.
Yeah, we're trying to put the fun into Japanese. You know, so many Japanese restaurants that you go to and everyone's whispering to you and sort of, you know, there's a lot of head nodding. That's lovely. Like that's the tradition of it's lovely, but we want to create a fun atmosphere.
Something that's a bit more funky.
Yeah.
There are one of my mates, Jane Lawson, who's in here quite frequently.
Right, yeah.
An incredible woman who just is such a Japanophile. It's ridiculous.
Yep.
And she looks a lot at some of the quite older traditional Kyoto style cuisines, mm-hmm. because Japan, like China and like Europe and everywhere else, has a diversity of cuisine from
Absolutely.
The south up to what they eat in Hokkaido or yep. Sapporo in the north. So it is quite a it's quite distinct in some regions,
yep.
and I think the stuff you're talking about sort of fits everywhere.
Yep, it's we do have some sort of more regional dishes. Like, say, okonomiyaki with Hokkaido scallops, you know,
okonomiyaki
celebrates, you know, the fact that in the cold regions you eat this, it's heartening, it's warm, it's filling, you know, it's a pimped up pancake.
Mm, with a nice filling.
Yeah, exactly right. So on a grand scale of things, though, you'd say that our food is pretty broad. It's very accessible, and it's not sort of heading down any one sort of
particular style.
Exactly right.
Maddie, having listened to that, how much does this then reflect again back on what you guys are doing from an innovation point of view?
Innovations, what we try to do, and I think it's a sort of works in the same way as like sensory play as a taco. You know, you don't expect to get that in the Japanese cuisine, but and then people are like, wow, it's a taco, wow, it's not a taco.
Mm.
You know, people, wow.
I'm so conflicted right now.
I was like, what do I do? What
Give
do
me
I
more
do?
Japanese mayonnaise.
So we try, definitely try and do a lot of that sort of stuff.
Yep.
I have reinvented the Swedish meatball. Some said Excellent. It couldn't be done. I said it had to be done.
It can't be done.
How have you reinvented Talk
so,
us through how that came about.
With that one, so we've actually made it into a croquette, which is really simple, but it was actually a nightmare to make. So we've put the meatball in the centre. So it's traditional dill, onion, shallots.
Yep.
Standard. Everything's same, 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 same,
same.
Something
we get at IKEA for $2.95 a plate.
Exactly right. then we wrap it in potato and crumb it in dark rye. And then we've done, rather than your lingonberry jam that you have everything, we've made that into a foam, and then the gravy is a gel. and it makes it look good. It's
a lot of both of you talking about a lot of very cool techniques. Before we go on, Maddie, a shout out to Maddie from Canberra. Does that mean something to you?
Don't know. Oh, like, my girlfriend's originally from Canberra, so she's
well, somebody you know is listening in Canberra because they've sent us a message. So
what's up, Canberra?
Hello, Canberra.
The nation's capital.
The nation's capital.
Which is actually blowing up at the moment. There's some good stuff going on up there.
Look, and this sort of was where I was going to get to a little bit later. We are seeing in regional Victoria, we're seeing in places like Canberra, Brisbane, where we sort of don't expect, there is some really clever people who are moving away from the tradition that we know of fine dining, if you will. And there is a whole movement. There is a lot of smart young people who've had a trip overseas or had some time overseas who are coming back to Melbourne and bringing with them, and it's being influenced out of the US probably most prominently, a very different way of eating, where you guys that are chefs and restaurateurs are actually cooking what you want to eat rather mm-hmm. than what is expected.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Happening a lot.
Yeah, very important as well. I mean, as a chef, you're hard to please no matter what, and you're always critical beyond the point where it's actually sane. So I think if you can cook something that you would like to eat and you would expect, like you go to dine somewhere and you're like, wow, I'd love to eat that.
Yep.
If you can cook that, then I think you'd succeed.
And if you can fit it into what you're doing.
Exactly
you
right. You can't go, hey, here's a
beef bourguignon and turn that into something Japanese, or you could.
Well, maybe we will.
Yeah.
Maybe we will. Maybe you've just given me an idea.
Stay tuned.
But, you know, I think we're sort of getting to a point where our cuisine is at some point down the track, I don't know when that's going to be, is going to become a universal cuisine.
Yes.
Rather than being talking about Korean or Japanese or talking about New Nordic or French or, you know, Italian or whatever it may be, we're seeing a melding of cuisines already, where it's not, I'm going to use probably a bad example, but Lucy Liu that's open, mm-hmm. Michael Lambie and Scott Borg have opened Lucy Liu in the old PM24 site, and it's a pan-Asian menu because it crosses almost every Asian border that influences exist, and the dishes are made up of a variety of Asian cuisines. So all of a sudden, that's not specifically one national cuisine, but it's a continental cuisine.
Yeah.
So it's the entire continent.
Last week we were out celebrating and we went there for dinner.
The food is spectacular.
So good.
And I was exactly the same. I had a drunken Hainanese chicken.
Yeah.
10 out of 10 dish. It was absolutely spectacular.
Fantastic.
Lambie's a great chef. He's a very talented man.
Been doing it for a long time. So I guess with the take on like a global...
Sorry, I nearly died.
Diet and thinking about melding the Asian flavors, we steer ourselves more down that Japanese path because we don't want to sort of be branded in that whole pan-Asian. I mean, there's so much definitive Japanese food, you know, with miso and dashi and
yuzu,
such a broad
and
range
kombu
of
and,
yeah, exactly, it's such a broad and diverse range of ingredients that we feel like we can really sort of target that and display it really well in a way that people aren't expecting. I think that's the thing.
I think one of the things that we look for as diners is an experience, something that is, you know, something that we won't create at home because we don't have the knowledge or the skill or the equipment.
Yeah,
that's what I eat when I eat out. I don't eat something that I can make at home, excepting the occasional chicken parmigiana, which has got to be my my weakness.
Joy 94.9.
Two talented young fellas in the studio. Kyle Duty is here from Mr. Miyagi and Maddie Fallon is here from Dunord on Little Bourke Street. And we are talking about innovation. And one of the discussions we were just having while we were playing that music was finding things that you need that aren't traditionally sold in stores and things. So you're talking about needing to find a taco holder.
Yeah, something to hold my taco. Yeah, the cup. Yeah, I've got to find something which isn't generally easily found. You get online and you look at taco holders and they're all hideous. So if anyone knows of anything which doesn't look like it's coming out of your grandmother's fourth drawer, you know, get on the website and contact me. Yes. Chef at Mr. Miyagi.
Or perhaps if you're somebody who makes things,
fantastic.
As a person who makes things out of things, you might be the person that Kyle's looking for. You can again find that on the website. So I want to talk a little bit about influence, and I know we've talked with you, Maddie, about the influence from New Nordic cuisine, but where did it all start? Because you haven't always cooked new Nordic cuisine, and you haven't always had a Japanese restaurant.
Not at all.
Where did the influence to do what you're doing now come from? I'm going to start with you, Kyle.
I was very lucky early in my career to have worked for a decent stint of time with Jacques Raymond.
Yep.
And I guess, you know, being the age of 22 at that stage, and I worked with him for almost 5 years, he opened my eyes to combining, you know, French cuisine and classic techniques with Asian flavors. Mm. You know, people went to the restaurant, they thought, oh, it's a French restaurant. Bœuf bourguignon, as you were saying, coq au vin. But, you know, it was more like pandan essence and quails and, you know, red miso. And so, you know, having that sort of insight at a sort of tender age as a young chef really helped me sort of forge where I wanted to take my cuisine.
Yep.
And I guess even though I did fine dining for 23 years, I've always had that sort of that drive to bring the Asian flavors into my cooking.
Mm. Maddie, you've had your career has gone on a whole bunch of like a rattlesnake. Sidewinder.
I've done Mexican before Mexican. Oh, after Mexican, I was doing Southern food, which I was obsessed with, which is now blown up.
Are your movements influenced by trend? Because there was that very big Mexican trend, and then I know there's been a Southern
The Mexican
movement.
Thing was just out of right time, right place sort of thing. Like, I didn't really follow that at all.
Right.
In saying that, I got onto doing Southern food from a guy I was working with in a Mexican restaurant. He was actually from New Orleans.
Yep.
So we started doing, like, gumbo and stuff like that.
So that Creole cuisine.
By all means. So, yeah, rather than sort of what everyone else is doing with smoked meats and all that sort of thing, we sort of went down the Cajun Creole sort of vibe with that. We did a whole bunch of pop-ups and things. So I don't know. Like, I never actually thought about it, whether we followed any sort of trend. Maybe
because these trends are happening.
Maybe it happened. I'm not sure, but yeah.
Mm.
But as far as the Nordic side of things,
what was that switch to take you from?
So the guys from De Nord, Thomas, who's been on the show before.
Yep.
Swedish expat. He wanted to do something along the lines of it, like, because the bar was already in place and it was Nordic themed.
Yep.
So the brief was try and tie it in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, like, neither of us thought we'd go to the extent that we have.
Yep.
And it's just, as soon as the sort of the Nordic side of things popped into my head, it was on. And
so did you just stick your head in a whole bunch of books and start to research?
All it was just books. And, like, it went from, like, 1960s cookbooks to current, like, Noma and all that sort of fabric. And
that Favican book is beautiful, by the way. If you are interested in cookbooks and you want to see something that's pretty spectacular, head out to Books for Cooks on Gertrude Street. Go and say hello to Tim White. He is the man who runs that store. The book Favican is absolutely stunning, written by Magnus Nielsen. This is a guy that has the world's most isolated restaurant. It is impeccable.
Amazing.
Mm.
Beautiful story, too. A lot of reading. It's a storybook as long as with a recipe.
And he was a sommelier. He worked as a sommelier in France before he went back to the homeland and decided to create something. And it's only 20 or 30 seats. May not even be that many.
Not even. I think it's like 16 seats or something like that. It's ridiculous. Like, it's a tiny space.
A farm
It's like a little barn, basically.
It's great for chefs. It's desolate. Not too many customers. We don't really deal well with the
general public. It's quite the thing, though, to get to and to experience. And it's not crazy expensive.
I didn't know that. I haven't looked into it.
I don't think it's crazy expensive. I might say it's not.
I wouldn't say it wouldn't be, but I'd just certainly would say they'd have to be chucking it.
And if you can picture in your head a typical Viking, he's got long blonde hair, he's a tall Swedish man, he's sort of broad-shouldered, and you can just sort of see him wrapped in a seal pelt or a moose.
There's
a lot of photos of him in his big fur coat and everything like that. It looks like he's actually killed the animal to make the coat.
Well, he does. And if you wanted to epitomise what a Viking might have looked like, there's your man.
There you go.
Just a really sweet, gentle sort of fellow as well. So
moose-killing man.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know that he kills the moose. Yeah. Mm. And sort of talks through philosophy, like he's a philosopher as much as he is a wonderful cook. I don't believe
he's full of knowledge, that's for sure.
Incredible knowledge.
He did something in Full magazine about Sweden, like the history of Scandinavian food, and he just knew absolutely everything.
Do you read a lot of Japanese cookbooks? I mean, is there a Japanese chef that you are particularly enamored by or whose work influences you?
I guess Japanese, Korean, American, David Chang. He's a bit of a hero of mine. You know, the fact that he's got the confidence, you know, he had a pretty good pedigree as a young chef, but
absolutely
decide to take that sideways step and say, I'm really confident in what I want to put on the plate. And if that's a slow-cooked egg, an onsen egg with damn good ramen, and I'm going to make my own kansui noodles, my own alkaline noodles, then that's what I'm going to do.
And then he's also leading this charge from some of the new Nordic techniques in preservation and preserving and that sort of stuff. It's interesting how those influences are happening all around the world. It's things like Red Zeppi's Mad Symposium that happens every year, where it is a collection of 25 or 30 of the world's edgier chefs. I won't say better or best, but certainly some of the edgier chefs who gather and exchange ideas. Ben Shuri from Attica is a very good friend of Renee's and heads to that symposium every year. And that's, you can see the influences that come from others in what Ben does, as much as each of Ben's dishes has its own story.
Yeah.
Mm. But Ben's a very big forager as well,
He's, absolutely.
He's always sourcing a samphire. Absolutely. And
And he's also probably one of the humblest chefs I've ever met.
Absolutely. Yeah, very humble.
It's not normally a word that's associated with chefs. Gentlemen, the one thing I like to finish with every week, you sort of have about a minute each, is your weakness. What is that thing at 1 o'clock in the morning, you go home, you know it's naughty, you know you should, what do you eat? What do you cook?
At the moment, I'm pretty time-starved, so it's actually been quite a lot of takeaway, and it's Hot Star large fried chicken.
Excellent. Fried chicken.
It's the most disgusting, amazing thing in the world. It's
brilliant. Well, it could be worse. It could be a worse, disgusting fried chicken, but we shall not. What's your weakness? You finish, it's 1 o'clock in the morning, you can't be bothered.
There's always rice in the house. There's always rice in the rice cooker just keeping warm. So it's just kimchi, slatherings of Japanese mayonnaise and cold beer.
Excellent. Man after my own heart. And I did not hear a toasted cheese sandwich or a tin of baked beans in that discussion. Guys, thank you. The website for Dunord?
Dunord.com.au.
Excellent. The website for Mr. Miyagi?
MrMiyagi.com.au.
Excellent. Guys, thank you for coming in and sharing this discussion about innovation. We are always interested to hear what is happening in our fair town. And sorry, people need to find you at
99 Chapel Street in Windsor.
Excellent.
367 Little Bourke Street.
367. Top end?
In between Hardware and Elizabeth.
Oh, bottom end.
Cambridge
Middle
Street.
End.
Yeah.
Middle end. There we go. And I will come in once I'm no longer tubby and eat your food, both of you.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.